Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, humanizing the legacy of Winston Churchill, and speaking of statecraft, we'll hear from a retired U.S. Army officer on the evolution of modern warfare. But first, the registration status for a huge number of voters in Arizona is on uncertain footing. Thanks to a quirk in Arizona state law, it's unclear which elections these voters are allowed to vote in. The situation has created serious headaches for county recorders who have been lobbying the state for some clarity on this. And joining us now to make sense of it all is VoteBeat reporter Jen Fifield, who has been covering the whole mess. Jen, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for being here. So let's start by clarifying the issue here. This is a group of voters who, it seems like through no fault of their own, are in a unique situation. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, and so these are residents who have lived here since at least 1996. I want to make that clear. Most everyone thinks that these are citizens. These are people who just were never asked to prove their citizenship when they registered to vote. And so these are people who have been in the state for decades, and now they're saying, we don't actually have proof of your citizenship, and in Arizona, you need that to vote in state and local elections. And so now, as we try to figure out what to do, the proposal is to kick them off the rolls entirely, of the voter rolls, if they don't provide this citizenship proof by 2026.
And so this proposal is a proposed piece of legislation, correct? And that's in reaction to a group of county recorders who have been trying to figure out how to proceed.
Right. So we have mostly Republican recorders in the state who are in agreement that this may be the way that we need to move forward. Now, this wasn't the proposal at first. And when this problem with the citizenship was discovered this summer, it was thought, okay, we're going to allow them to provide their citizenship. If they don't, we're just going to let them vote in federal elections like other voters who have not yet proved citizenship. Now the idea is we're going to kick them off the rolls entirely. This seems to be getting caught up in the nationwide focus on proof of citizenship and all the politics involved with proving citizenship to vote, when we know that these are longtime voters, longtime residents, who, like you said, it's not their fault that they didn't provide their citizenship yet. So there is a bit of disagreement on how to move forward, and the Secretary of State's office is saying, do not kick them off the rolls.
Yes. Well, I'm glad you brought up the Secretary of State's office, because if I'm not mistaken from your reporting, it seems like initially the recorders approached the Secretary of State's office for some guidance and did not necessarily get a clear sense of how to proceed.
The Secretary of State, Adrian Fontes, has always said that he likes to leave these kind of decisions up to counties. It might be also a legal strategy that, you know, if now the counties are sued, they're making their own legal decisions on how to move forward. But the Secretary of State did step in when he saw this new proposal to kick them off the rolls, and his office said, wait, what are we doing here? Don't do that. These are, you know, we know who these voters are, and if they don't provide citizenship, at least make them federal-only voters.
Now, some folks listening to this may be thinking to themselves, wait a minute, I thought we talked about this last fall. So give us the context there. The state Supreme Court issued a ruling on this back in September, and at the time, it seemed like everybody was kind of on the same page. So what's changed?
That's right. Before the election, it was, you know, just a few months before ballots went out, or even a month before they went out, everyone just said, let's hold off on this issue until after November. We don't want these longtime residents who are probably citizens to just suddenly find that they're not able to cast a ballot in the presidential election. But since then, as you know, there's been a lot of national talk about proof of citizenship. There's a lot of pressure on Republicans in the state to act certain ways. And I think that might be playing into what's happening here now, where there's there's differing opinions. No matter what, I see this going to the court in some way if we don't get a standard approach moving forward.
And one of the reasons that it's tricky to kind of parse all this, right, has to do with a 2022 law, which has created some confusion here about whether the regulations apply to newly registered voters or to these several hundred thousand voters who, as you said, have been on the rolls for much longer, right?
Right. It's so hard to talk about this and simplify it. But basically, our state laws, there's so many new state laws, too, on proof of citizenship. And one of them that is now in effect or is in the courts, we'll see if it goes into effect, says you can't become a full ballot voter. You can't become a voter at all if you don't provide proof of citizenship using the state registration form. So it's based on what you use to register to vote. That's causing more of the mix up and more of the confusion on how to move forward here.
And just to be clear, Jen, Secretary of State Fontes's office has, since the dust-up about all this, formally sent a letter trying to clear up their stance on how we should proceed. What is their position?
Their position is if these voters don't provide the proof of citizenship by 2026, then maybe we should make them federal-only voters like others in the state who have not provided that proof, which means they would be able to vote for president, for Congress, but not for things like governor and local races. I do want to also clarify that you do have to be a citizen everywhere to vote, even in federal elections, and you have to attest to that under penalty of perjury. You have to check something when you register saying, I am a citizen. These voters have done that already. So I just want to be clear about that because some people say, wait, I thought you did have to be a citizen to vote in any kind of election.
And just about 30 seconds left here, Jen. What's the urgency on this?
Well, I mean, some counties have elections in next month. Some have them in May. We might have a statewide election, probably not this year, but we need to figure this out pretty quickly here.
Yes. Well, thank you for your reporting on this, Jen. We know it is difficult to parse, but we appreciate the good work you do. Jen Fifield, a reporter for VoteBeat, thank you, as always, for joining us.
Thanks so much.
A few months into newly elected Sheriff Jerry Sheridan's term at the helm of Maricopa County's extensive network of jails, and overdoses are going up. Earlier this month, the sheriff's office announced there had been a dozen overdoses in one jail in the past week. One person died. Then Fox 10 reported the following day that two more overdoses were reported at the all-women's Estrella jail. The drugs, they believe, are being smuggled in by inmates. The office says it's installing X-ray machines to help mitigate the problem, and Sheriff Sheridan is here in studio now to tell us more. Good morning, Sheriff. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So tell us how bad this overdose problem has gotten. It has been bad for, you know, over the years. You'll hear, you know, see headlines here and there of more overdoses being reported. The Arizona Republic now is reporting that the jails are seeing much higher overdose rates so far in 2025 than it did last year. What's it look like from your point of view?
It's bad. It's not good. It has been very bad for the last 8 years. And when I became a sheriff in January, I inherited some of the issues. And so we've been making some big steps to try to mitigate the amount of drugs and, of course, the overdoses. And we've had one death. So I'm very concerned about that. I'm the sheriff, and I feel personally responsible for those deaths.
Let me ask you what's behind it. And before we talk about solutions here, you say these drugs are being smuggled in by inmates. Most of them so far are at the women's jail. What's it look like?
Well, it is. The drugs come in most of the time in the jail system from prisoners that come off the street, and they carry them in their body cavities. Mm-hmm. And we cannot search the body cavities unless we know for sure that there's something in there. Then we have to get a search warrant and a medical provider to remove the drugs.
Your predecessor, Paul Penzone, had installed body scanning equipment for this purpose to prevent drugs and other contraband from getting into the jails. You have said you're installing X-ray machines to help address this problem. Would that be in addition to those body scanning machines?
Correct. Those body scanning machines that the previous administration brought in don't go into body cavities. It's just like at the airport. They're line scan machines, mm-hmm. like the X-rays where you put the bags in, and also the one where you hold your arms up. You know, I think we've all been through those. But they don't go into the body cavities. They just look through the clothing.
So one of the big changes that you made when you took office was to get rid of a requirement that your predecessor had also put into place to scan employees as well as they enter the jails. That came after an employee was found guilty of smuggling drugs into the jails. You took away that requirement. Tell us why.
I did, because in my experience of 25 years overseeing the jail system and monitoring what was going on, there have been two sheriff's employees that have been found to bring drugs in. That's two over about 25 years. And I didn't think that I'm sending the right message if I continued with not trusting my employees, about 2,000 of them, when only two in 25 years have done something wrong. And so that really helped. But I've also put a couple of other things in place. Mm-hmm. And we have drug-sniffing dogs in the intake. They don't work as good as an X-ray machine would to find these drugs. But I've also upped the amount of what we call shakedowns, jail shakedowns, where we have teams of officers and our special response team. It's kind of like the jail SWAT team to go in and do searches. Also, I'm beefing up the jail intelligence unit. And I had a very big jail intelligence unit when I was there, when I was the chief over the jail system. And they prevented a lot of drugs from coming in the first place.
So some other measures you can take. Have any of the incidents so far in 2025 involved employees that you know of?
No.
So have you heard from employees that they feel better about that? Did they feel like they were being targeted under the old policy?
They felt like they weren't trusted. And believe me, we hire people. They go through extensive training, background, polygraph, psych tests, and all this stuff. We hire the best employees, and so I trust them to do their job. Occasionally, let's face it, occasionally somebody goes rogue and does something, but it's such a rare thing that I'm not going to blame the other 2,000 people and put them through that.
Let me ask you about other things you can do here. You mentioned, you know, X-ray machines in addition to these body scan machines that would give you the chance to, you know, get the warrant to search someone's body cavities, right? What else can you do? Is this about putting more naloxone in jails? A lot of the drugs being smuggled into the air, fentanyl, which are so and so quickly fatal.
Right. Fentanyl is such a dangerous drug. It doesn't take very much. And so the problems we had in Australia jail, we had some overdoses in a housing unit. We thought we identified the woman that had the drugs. We moved her to another housing unit, and lo and behold, within a few hours, we had two more overdoses. So we identified who this is. We are in the process of seeing if we can't make a manslaughter case against her and some other crimes. So we are actively pursuing that.
Mm. Is it also about training officers to detect this really quickly because it can become fatal so fast?
Yes, absolutely. All officers have Narcan on them, and so they immediately give them Narcan when we see somebody that's not doing well.
Mm-hmm. So a few years ago, I had toured the jails with the former sheriff, Paul Penzone, and he had showed me all the measures they had put into place to try to prevent this, but the numbers were still high. I wonder, at a certain point, do you see this as kind of impossible? Like, is there a foolproof system here?
There's never a foolproof. You're always going to have drugs in a jail and a prison. And there is a difference between jails and prisons, by the way. But officers have to be ever diligent. We have to do our job. And one of the big problems that we have, too, is I'm about 840 officers short. Mm-hmm. So sometimes inmates aren't searched thoroughly because they don't have the time to do it. And we move a lot of inmates between one facility and another, so they get moved around. And sometimes those drugs will get past the search process.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. That is Maricopa County's newly elected sheriff, Jerry Sheridan. Thank you for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. Welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, the art and craft behind personal storytelling. But first, here's a bit of good news for you. Suicide rates among Native Americans in New Mexico have dropped by more than 40%. This among a population that has suicide rates 91% higher than the general population. The data comes from the New Mexico Department of Health, which reports that, among American Indians, suicides dropped 43% from 77 deaths in 2022 to 44 in 2023. What's behind it? A shift in perspective, according to our next guest. Dr. Deirdre Yellowhair is an assistant research professor in psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the University of New Mexico. Her work focuses on creating culturally safe mental health care for tribal members, and my co-host, Lauren Gilger, spoke with her more about the improvements.
It was really great news to watch how the data was telling a story about the efforts that have been made throughout New Mexico. You know, one of the things that I think the data shows us is that this is a multi-agency, multi-community effort. This really reflects the grassroots movement. It is the community members who are out there, who are providing that community education, who are getting in touch with members of the community, members of their family, youth in the community, and making those person-to-person connections. Mm-hmm. And then working with therapeutic agencies, behavioral health agencies, schools like UNM, tribal community resources, you know, all of those things. It took a great effort from multiple sources, I think, to be able to achieve the kind of data that we're seeing.
Yeah, such an effort behind this, it sounds like. And before this, it sounds like in the years prior to, at least, there had been a big rise in suicides among Native Americans in New Mexico. And suicide rates, we should say, are already higher nationwide among this population. Talk a little bit about why. Like, what are some of the factors that have led to that being a truism in this country for so long?
There's no one answer why suicide rates have been higher in American Indian communities, more so than any other racial ethnic group. I think it really has a lot to do with the systemic policies, different systems, academic systems, judicial systems, larger systems that have policies that aren't always as culturally adaptable or accessible to American Indians and their perspective of life and their understanding of wellness, what it means to be holistically well, that somewhere in there, there's a lot of mistranslation that happens. If you don't know how a group of people defines wellness and you have this, you know, overall structure of health that you're imposing on to this group of people without really understanding their perspective, you're not treating what needs to be treated. And I think that's something that has happened for generations across tribal communities.
Right. Okay. So you're getting at this idea here that I want to talk about, which is that what you've done in the state, you and many other people have, is to create a culturally appropriate prevention response to this problem, right? Like, what does that mean? What does it look like? It sounds like it's like creating a baseline almost.
You know, when we talk about culturally appropriate treatments, it really starts with the community. Because it's the community that gets to define what is their culture, what are important values and core pieces of their language, their traditions, and their culture that are valuable, that anchor them to community, to family, to life. So culturally appropriate interventions, preventions, and even postvention activities really start by listening to the community. Mm-hmm. How do they define wellness? How do they define illness? And how do then we begin to utilize culture as therapy? Mm. Because we know that it works. You know, we talk a lot about evidence-based practices in Western academics. And when we're in the ivory tower universities, we talk about evidence-based practices. Yeah. Well, look around the United States. There are over 570-something federally recognized tribes, and there's still countless others that are not recognized that are still here. That is your evidence. Hmm. That is your evidence that culture is the therapy, that when you have culture to ground you, to make those people-to-people connections, to make those connections with your environment, to make those connections with your community, that then creates those protective factors that then help with strengthening a person, a family, and ultimately a community.
Hmm. The culture is the medicine. That's so interesting. So
absolutely.
You've worked in clinical settings to try to implement some of this. Talk a little bit about the practical implication of that for us and tell us what that looks like in treatment, in therapy approaches, in, I guess, even just the words you use, right? I read some cultures don't even have a direct translation for the word depression, right? Like this is about even the most basic things in creating an understanding.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've worked both in tribal communities I've worked on Navajo, where I'm from, but I've also worked in tribal communities that I am not a native language speaker of, and I am not native to. And I think one of the most important things is often letting people tell their stories, because storytelling is a huge part of many of our cultures. Many of our cultures and our languages were not written, and they've always been transmitted orally, you know, stories that have been passed down from generation to generation. So storytelling is a big part of it, and letting people, even kids have stories, and giving them a safe space in a therapeutic setting to just tell their stories can make such a huge impact.
Yeah.
To let them know that their stories matter, to let parents who have been, you know, stigmatized, maybe isolated by labels of being a bad parent, being involved with CPS, being involved with like all these other systems, those labels have impact. But when you take a moment to just listen to stories, It empowers people to utilize their voice to tell their own story without judgment, without fear, without repercussion.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also different ways we utilize culture in intergenerational connections, connecting the youth with their elders and connecting elders with their youth. And it's community building. For so long, practitioners have come into tribal communities and have said, this is the way it works everywhere else. So we're gonna make it work here, or we want you to make it work here.
Right.
But a lot of times those treatment methodologies aren't normed, aren't created for Indigenous or tribal communities. But starting from the ground, that grassroots level, and listening to the community and how they define culture and wellness, It is treatment that's created for them, by them, for their benefit.
Is this a model that can be replicated, Deidre, around the country? Like, can you take these lessons that you've learned there, this improvement that you've seen in the numbers themselves, and repeat it and make this something that is helping people all over?
I absolutely believe it can be replicated if we listen to people and what their needs are, If we listen to communities and what their needs are, because a community here in rural New Mexico, where there isn't infrastructure to support telehealth, there's no running water, there's no electricity. And there are communities like that. They're in Arizona, where the largest part of the Navajo Nation exists. There are still communities that are so remote. So the treatment there for those community members is going to look different for a family or a community in urban Phoenix or Albuquerque. So we have to get away from this idea that treatment is one size fits all.
All right. We'll leave it there then. Dr. Deidre Yellowhair joining us, assistant research professor in psychology and behavioral sciences within the Division of Community Behavioral Health at the University of New Mexico. Thank you so much, Deidre, for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. A new production at Phoenix Theater bills itself as An Evening with Winston Churchill. It's a solo show written, directed, and performed by David Payne in collaboration with his son, Daniel Payne. David and Daniel came by the studio recently to talk about their approach to finding a unique angle on the story of Churchill, who, of course, has been extensively dramatized for decades. But the Paynes were determined to find a more humanistic approach to the character. And in that spirit, I want to let you know that the interview that you're about to hear takes a somewhat surprising turn partway through. We've decided to air it as it happened, because it is what happened, but also because I think it speaks to the Paynes' artistic sensibilities. we began our conversation with David Payne telling a story from early in the theatrical run of Churchill.
It was an afternoon performance, and during the interval, the house manager came up to me and said, "There's a lady would like to meet you. She used to be in charge of the staff at two of Churchill's houses." So I said, "I'm happy to meet her." She was 82 years old, very frail in one sense, but sharp as a tack. She came up to me, and I wondered, this lady knows Churchill.
Yeah.
What on earth is she going to say? She didn't say anything. She just threw her arms around me.
Oh, my goodness. Well, okay, so thank you for sharing that anecdote. It really stuck out to me, one, because it's obviously a testament to the authenticity that you're achieving in the performance, but it also made me think about something else I've heard you say, which is that your main goal with this production is for the audience to come out of it saying to themselves, "I felt I was with the man." Why is that important to you as a performer? Because I could imagine a performer saying that their goal for a production like this is, you know, for people to understand the untold story of this person's life, and that would be equally valid. But I really like this idea of, for you, there's something experiential about spending time in the company of this person that is meaningful to you.
It's so important that people forget the actor. David Payne doesn't matter. What matters is, do they think they're with Churchill, or it's as though they're with Churchill? And if you do that, I think you've won the battle. I want people to find the humanity,
yes,
in the characters I play. And that's why when he talks about his wife, and so candidly, in a very positive way, some ladies are even in tears.
Well, you've anticipated my next question then, because maybe it's in this anecdote that you just shared, but I'm very curious, as you sat down to begin writing this, because you're also the author of this play, was there some anecdote, some tendril about him that you hit upon that made you think, that's the way in? That's the key to understanding Churchill as a man.
I thought the key to understanding Churchill as a man was not to concentrate on his leadership of Great Britain during the World War, but to concentrate on the years that led up to his leadership. What was it in his life that prepared him for that role? He actually says, as he looks back on his life, "My childhood were the most unhappy years of my life." He had to deal with things like his parents often being distant, not because they didn't care for him, but they were always in the public eyes. Mother was in high society. His father was a politician. He talks about that he loved his parents, but at times it was at a distance. It's these things that say, this is what shaped the man.
Mm-hmm. So speaking about the idea of parents and Churchill's relationship to them, it seems like an ideal moment, Daniel, to bring you into the conversation. Daniel, you are David's son, and you are the alternate for Churchill in this production. What for you resonates with the character of Churchill being, you know, a generation younger, but still needing to connect with the idea of, again, finding the man?
So I think the thing that I am most drawn to in the character, and actually I'd say that my father has parallels in this in his own personality, it's his sensitivity. You always kind of think of a war leader as being rough and gruff and muscled, and he wasn't. He's a very demure figure. He's a tiny guy, but he was also hugely emotional. And actually, he talks about it a lot. And I'm sorry, I'm not saying you're hugely emotional, but you are. You're very much in touch with that. And Churchill was a great blubberer.
Yeah,
and I think then that probably wasn't something that was really pushed, because, you know, stiff upper lip and all that. And I think even today, you know, for boys and men, you want to be masculine. And actually, being sensitive and being gentle and being emotional and allowing yourself to be emotional, I think is really important. And I that's something I really love about Churchill.
I would imagine that your ability to even articulate that, Daniel, has to be a result of a certain modeling of a type of masculinity on your part, David, as a father.
So I think it's not something that we would necessarily talk about a lot, but it's something that I would, you know, you witness. And I think it's the nature of our nuclear family. My mother, my brother, and my father. We're always laughing. We're always really open with each other. I think when my mother died, that was a particular moment where I saw the vulnerability in my father, because I've never seen something impact him in such a way before.
Can I ask, just because you spoke about one of the humanizing elements of Churchill for you as a writer being his relationship with his wife, how much of that was informed by your relationship and your appreciation with Daniel's mom?
Hard to answer that one there. I can't deal with it.
Sorry, that was my fault.
I'm all right. Sorry about that.
I apologize for asking a very sensitive question.
No, it's a fair question. It's just, I'm not over it. I never will be over it. She was the light of our lives, really. And she died unexpectedly, so you didn't really have a chance to say goodbye.
Of course.
Anyway, I'm all right now.
Sorry, I might have. I led us down that path.
No, you haven't. No, you just said what you felt. That was fine. Well, you were answering the question.
But there you go. That's what I'm talking about, is that.
And that I opens. Think that helps me when I'm talking about Winston. That does help me when I realize how important Clementine was to him. I've been able to explore the emotion because of my relationships. I've been able to explore the emotion of the tragedy,
yeah,
which is very important.
Yes. Well, David Payne is the writer, the director, and the principal performer in Churchill, currently playing at Phoenix Theater. And his son, Daniel Payne, is his alternate and close collaborator. Thank you both so much for this conversation.
Thank you.
No, thank you very much. It's been great.
The 21st century has already seen plenty of armed conflict around the world. But how different are these more current wars than those from the past? The answer from our next guest may surprise you. Amos Fox is a retired U.S. Army officer. He retired last year after 24 years in the Army. He's also a professor of practice at ASU's Future Security Initiative and author of the book Conflict Realism: Understanding the Casual Logic of Modern War and Warfare. He'll be speaking about this tonight at a virtual event sponsored by the Future Security Initiative. My co-host, Mark Brody, spoke with Fox and asked how different war is now than it has been in years and generations past.
Yeah, so this is the fun part. This is where I drew a lot of ire many times. The short answer is it's not. The only thing that's truly different are the toys that are at play. And at the end of the day, it all comes down to two sides wanting different things and fighting about which side gets their way. So the only thing that's really changed is the tools that are used to try and kill each other, if we're being frank. And so that's changed significantly, obviously, just like living life has changed significantly. We no longer live in mud huts or cave carve-outs, right? We live in fairly sophisticated homes. We drive fairly sophisticated cars. And so war hasn't necessarily changed at some revolutionary speed that's just mind-blowing to the average human being. It's basically stayed on step or slightly ahead of the modern technology we use in our everyday life.
I would imagine, though, when you mentioned, you know, the tools have changed, the weapons have changed, that's got to cause or lead to some pretty significant changes in how wars are waged, right?
Again, this is another one of those, I'm going to throw a curveball and say no. Huh. Right at the end of the day, things have been slung at each other either at close range or at distance from the beginning. And so, again, it's comparable to the technologies at play in everyday life to the technologies that are used in war. So it's just the way that we can get long-range fires fired has changed significantly, obviously. Just like we can fly airplanes across the world, we can now fire rockets and missiles across the world. And that really hasn't been much different since, you know, Second World War.
So I guess given, you know, all the technologies, as you say, you know, there are new technologies in war and conflict, just like there are new technologies in our everyday life. I guess maybe the question, if your argument is that it hasn't really changed that much, what kind of impact maybe has it had? The fact that, you know, you can send a drone now to, you know, deliver a bomb, for example, as opposed to having to have a human fly a plane that could get shot down and cause an injury or death or lead to somebody's capture, or more, you know, precision guided weaponry. Like, what kind of impact maybe has that had on how war happens and how it's carried out now than it has in the past?
Yeah, so the first impact in my assessment is that it's made for the ability to disperse a bit greater, right? So you don't have to cluster together to fight. Now, that isn't to say that not clustering together is beneficial. If anything, that perhaps prolongs conflict in ways we didn't necessarily anticipate. But it's allowed for the dispersal of forces, right? At the same time, too, you know, the drone aspect, and this is where it's important to understand that almost all wars are still land wars, right? They're either fought for a piece of terrain, like you see in Ukraine, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I use that as an example to illustrate, like, it's a land war, right? It's fought for land. It's fought for possession of land. It's fought for controlling territory. And so as long as wars remain land wars, drones are just an auxiliary element of how militaries and non-state militaries fight. And so that dynamic is not new. That dynamic has existed for forever. And this is where part of this hype around drones is just that. It's hype. It's people looking at a technology and saying, oh, my God, this is a game changer. When, no, it's not. This is just the continuity of warfare. It has removed an element of human sacrifice to a degree. But it also raises the question, if we go back to what we talked about at the beginning, where we talked about the ability to shoot further and faster is now a reality. Does that then make drone operation stations, say in Nevada, you know, for drones that are operating in, you know, if we go back to Afghanistan and how we, you know, used a lot of those drones that were, or even Iraq for that matter, those drones are being flown from flown in Afghanistan and Iraq from Nevada, right? Does that then make that, you know, nice little Air Force base in Nevada a target for hypersonic long-range strikes from whomever?
Do you think that policymakers and maybe just the American general public really think about war in the same way? Or do you think maybe that has changed, those perceptions have changed a little bit?
So the American public, outside of the thank you for your service because I don't have to go aspect, no, I don't think they do. By and large, they think that it's somebody else's problem. And by that, I mean people like me that spent 24 years doing it. You know, I spent 3 years of my life in Iraq. I think a lot of times, at least in my experience, when I saw people like, oh, thanks, you know, blah, 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 it was more out of at least you're doing it instead of me, right? And so there's that aspect. And then you saw also, we the U.S., wanted to keep these open-ended conflicts going. And the best way to keep the open-ended conflict going was to not tax your civilian, your domestic population, right? Not make the burdens of war so great on them that they get frustrated and start pushing back on policy through a variety of means, you know, demonstrations and whatnot, like you saw in the Vietnam War. And so that's led to the pursuit of other ways about going about staying involved in armed conflict. And so we've tried to, you know, offset a lot of these conflicts to make them very small boots on the ground oriented conflicts where we're doing using other people to fight for us, but then providing them with all these drones, all these long range fires, all this stuff that protects the civilian population in the US from having to actually get involved in the conflict or appreciate the scale and scope of the conflict to keep that off their plate so that we can keep ourselves involved in all these conflicts. So I think on the policymaker side, yes, it's intentional in terms of how we've constructed these campaigns and the technologies to help us conduct the campaigns and to keep them going, but to do so in a way that keeps the domestic population largely disconnected from it. It's not even a concern to them. I think it's important for the domestic audience in the U.S. to be interested in what's going on as it relates to foreign policy and the wars that we're participating in, because it does come at a high cost, not just for us, but for humanity, right? And at the end of the day, as human beings, I think we should all care about the effects of U.S. foreign policy on humanity.
Sure. All right. That is Amos Fox, a retired U.S. Army officer, currently professor of practice with ASU's Future Security Initiative. Amos, thanks so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Mark, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate the opportunity.
Good morning and welcome back once again to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Carly Davis is a storytelling instructor. She teaches at South Mountain Community College, working with people who want to tell true autobiographical stories in public. Some of them do it for performance purposes, others in business environments, but they all have one thing in common, a desire to share their truth. But now, Carly is putting a twist on the medium. For a new show called Liar Liar at Royale Kitchen tomorrow night, Carly and her co-producers will present an evening of live personal stories, but one of them will be completely made up. I recently spoke with Carly about the power of personal storytelling, both true and false.
When I'm coaching a new person who is nervous, I acknowledge that public speaking is usually people's number one fear after sharks. And then I can guarantee that there's no sharks involved.
Some people, I bet it's before sharks.
But I sincerely think that we all have many, many stories. And that desire to want to share them and to connect with folks in the audience is really strong. And that's something that they probably all have in common.
Can you think of any personal experiences in your own journey as a storyteller where it felt particularly revelatory for you to be in front of people telling a story from your own life?
Well, actually, the first story that I told in a public or professional setting, people came up to me afterwards and wanted to share their version of my experience and all different ages. And that was such a lovely feeling that people could come out of the woodwork in that way and want to talk.
There's something so fundamentally powerful about the idea of an event where the proposition to people is your experiences matter, and they matter simply because they happened. One of the reasons I'm interested in talking to you about this is because I think something that many people who have not been to a storytelling show before don't think about as much with this particular medium is that it really is storytelling, and this is just my opinion, so tell me if you disagree. It really is storytelling more than truth-telling. It is true experiences, of course, but the imperative is to turn it into a compelling narrative, right? How do you think about that balance?
That has come up with a couple different folks that I have worked with. Journalists in particular, actually, they have such been trained to remove I from their reporting and from their stories. And so, you know, the inclination is to tell the story and keep it at arm's length, where you are just narrating a series of events. And that's not inviting your listener in. That's not doing all those things that storytelling should do about building connection when we keep it at arm's length. And so my mentor, Megan Finnerty, always opens with that acknowledgement that that storytelling is a visit. And so that
is... Oh, that's beautiful.
I believe there are three equal parts to a storytelling experience. There's the teller, of course, and there is the audience, and there's also the story itself. And they all rely on each other, and they all are different every time. It's responsive.
Right, right. The way that you perform the story to the room of people that you're in
it is not going to be a good performance if the performance doesn't acknowledge that room and those people.
Absolutely. And people have such a finely tuned instrument for authenticity.
Well, that's the experience you had, right? Mm-hmm. That you were sharing was that you told a story early on. Would you be comfortable saying what that story was about?
The theme for that show was Schools Out. And I happened to change schools growing up every year in middle school, which on itself is a lot. But on top of that, every year when I got to a new school, that was the year that school was doing sex ed. So I got it four times.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, that's a that's a great equalizer. We've all been humiliated middle schoolers.
See, that's such a wonderful example, Carly, because that's the kind of thing that you laying out those specifics, it feels, I'm sure, in your experience, like so unique. And yet you had all these people come up to you afterwards and say, something like that happened to me once.
Absolutely. And my school experiences, they were all terrible in different ways, which also kind of throws open the door for other people to connect with the story, actually. Right. You know, some of it was in a church school setting. Some of it was in a very large public school. All of it was in the South. So that throws open the doors for people to see themselves reflected in my story.
And I have to imagine that, I mean, oftentimes we're telling stories like this from a place where in the moment that this thing was happening, you're like, you feel like I am alone. And that's terrible when it's happening. But then when you tell the story, you get to have this experience of, I'm not alone. Because
Absolutely.
All these other people.
Yeah. And it's laugh with, you know, not at. I think part of that transformation with feeling not alone also happens in the crafting, because we know this on a neurological level, actually, that stories live in the creative right side of our brain that is generative, creative, emotional. But the act of crafting a story moves it to the left side of the brain, which is analytical, which is where we make choices about structure and what words to use and how to put the story together. I look at that as really a physical transformation as well as something for the storyteller, because especially with a story that involves some kind of a trauma or hardship, transferring it to a story, crafting it into a story, makes it something manageable.
That's a very beautiful idea, this idea that in turning an experience into a story, you are, as you just laid out, literally moving it around in your body.
Yeah.
And making it so that it doesn't feel
as heavy.
Stuck.
Yeah.
One of the reasons that I'm interested in experiences like that is because you are about to do this show where part of the premise is that at least one person on the stage is just going to be straight up lying.
Well, that is my privilege, that once you know the rules, you can flip them, right?
Right.
And so what would make a lie story land is the same things that would make a true story land. It's pictures, it's emotions, it's connecting, it's looking for the universal in the story. And so that's why this was such a fun concept, to kind of flip what we all take for granted. We are coaching all of the storytellers ahead of the performance so that they know that their story is going to land, their jokes will make sense, and we know how the audience might receive it. And so we want them to walk out and feel like $1 million and know that it's going to work. I thought everyone would want to tell the lie story, but once we got into it a little bit, they realized, oh, it's work.
Isn't that interesting? It's harder to tell a lie.
Well,
in
to
this
tell
environment.
A lie well.
To tell a lie well, yeah. Sorry.
And that's my fallback when I'm working with storytellers, to reassure them and say, hey, look, your story is true and you were there. You're not going to forget it. It's going to take care of itself, right? And so when you take away both of those elements, then it is harder.
The way you're talking about this, it almost feels like a sort of subversive way of reminding people how important true storytelling is by kind of putting into relief how deceptive a well-told lie could be.
Sure.
Is that fair to say?
It is. And that's been something I've really been thinking about the last few weeks as we've pulled this together, that because also there's an element where the audience is participating in that they are voting on who they think the liar is. And so there's prizes for the storyteller and for the audience for guessing right. But what that also does, though, is it makes them get into a space of active listening.
And it strikes me, that it is contiguous with this idea of a visit.
Absolutely.
If you think of it more like a visit with the truth, mm-hmm. this is entirely coherent within that framing.
I do love that tension.
All right. Well, Carly Davis is the co-producer of Liar Liar, which will be at Royale Kitchen February 26th at 7. And Carly is also half of the Arizona Story Lab. Carly, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.